We're talking diabetes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new patented device is now on the market to help people with diabetes safely inject insulin with one hand. It's called SteadyShot. It's mounted on a standard insulin injector. Do you struggle with taking insulin shots? What type of device do you use? What don't you like about how you inject your insulin right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Shawn Michaels is a type 1 diabetic who invented the SteadyShot device in 2016 while earning his business degree at UW-Madison. Shawn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Can you help us understand what SteadyShot is? What did you invent?
Yeah. So when you're type 1 diabetic or diabetic in general, you either have to inject insulin or get it in the form of an insulin pump. So for people who use insulin pens, they have pen needles, and then SteadyShot attaches directly to standard pen needles, making it easier to use one hand and reach new injection sites. So if you're stuck injecting in your easy-to-reach spots and you start getting a condition called lipohypertrophy, which is bruising and scar tissue at your injection site, now SteadyShot makes it really easy to avoid injecting those areas and reach new injection sites.
Oh, so because if you keep going back to the same injection site, you're going to get bruising and other issues under the skin?
Yep. So on average, a diabetic will inject 3 to 5 times per day. So that's 1,100 to 1,800 injections per year. So as you can imagine, if you keep injecting in the same spot, those injections are going to add up, and then you're going to start having some bruising and scar tissue happen after a little bit.
So your device, it attaches to the your injector pen, and then it helps you stabilize your hand so you can try different areas?
Yep. So you typically, there's 5 injection sites, which are your stomach, thighs, arms, back, and butt. And most people like to inject in their stomach and thighs. So about 38% of insulin injectors have lipohypertrophy, and this happens from not rotating injection sites and reusing insulin pen needles. So SteadyShot makes it really easy to reach any injection site. And then say you're left-handed and you don't know how to use your right hand to inject, now you can easily use your right hand to inject in, say, your left arm, because now it stabilizes the needle for you and you don't have to worry about keeping your arm stable.
How is SteadyShot different from other insulin injection tools that are out there?
Yeah, so there's only one similar injection tool out there in the UK called TickleFlex, but that is more aimed towards alleviating pain and not necessarily rotating towards injection sites. And I bought it and tried it out, and it didn't work very well for me. So I think SteadyShot's a much better product, and it's not only just for helping you rotate injection sites. So we've had young injectors use it who are just learning injections, and they said it's been much easier to give injections. It's like training wheels for the needle. Or if you're older, you have dexterity or arthritis, now it's easier to insert the needle and use one hand. So there's a multitude of benefits for it, and there's really nothing like it out there on the market. It's just a one-of-a-kind, unique device.
We're talking with Shawn Michaels, who invented a new insulin injection device in 2016. It helps stabilize the injection pen. How do you take your insulin? Do you use a needle and syringe, a pen pump, an inhaler, another device? Tell us about your preferences with insulin. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Shawn, tell us about your experience learning that you had diabetes. How did you find out?
Yeah, so I was a junior in high school. I was a 3-sport athlete at the time, so I was in really good athletic shape. But in my strength and conditioning class one day, I just was getting super winded doing the easiest workouts, and it didn't really make any sense because, like, I work out regularly, and I've never gotten winded that often. So that was the first big red flag because I was passed out for, like, 15 to 30 minutes just in the corner after a simple sprint workout. And then at a basketball game, I started to just drink just tons of water, just trips to the bathroom, trips to the bubbler, water fountain way too often. And I ended up Googling diabetes symptoms, found out I had basically every symptom, went into the doctor and they took a blood test and then came back and told me that I had type 1 diabetes. So it happened pretty quick after I started noticing the symptoms, but it was just basically every symptom you see online I had, and I figured there had to be some sort of correlation going on.
What kind of challenges did you face while managing your insulin?
Yeah, so when you're first diagnosed, you go through a week or longer training class where they teach you about carbohydrate counting, calculating your insulin doses, and then basically just learning how to live with elevated or lower blood sugar levels and how to correct them. So it was just adjusting to all of that. I found out to be the toughest at first. And then once I started getting seasoned as a diabetic and then knew how to give injections and injected way too many times in my stomach and thighs, that was the next biggest problem I had. So then I made steady shots, helped me rotate away from those overused injection sites. And now I don't have that problem anymore.
So you feel like you're able to do your injections confidently in the other areas and not just your stomach or your thighs?
Yeah, so the first time I made steady shot, I was able to inject in my arms. I never injected in my arms before that. And then I never actually even knew you could inject in your butt. But then I came across a first tester who heard that some people tried it. And then it makes that easier to do when you're injected in your butt. So then I started injecting in my butt and my back. And then it just made it a lot easier to give that larger dose too. So there's two different types of insulin that you can inject. It's your fast-acting and your long-acting. And your long-acting is usually a much bigger dose. So you have to hold the needle in the skin longer. So I found that with steady shot, now if you're reaching an awkward injection site and you have to give a really big dose, it's much easier to do that now because that dose can take anywhere from 5 to 10 seconds to administer all the medicine. So it really helps you out with that too.
How important is it to have a diabetic manage and run the company Steady Shot?
I think it's really important because I'm having the same problem that all these other diabetics are having too. So I feel like it gives legitimacy to the device. It's a big problem that tons of people have. And then I feel like I can really resonate with the end injector because tons of people have this problem. And it's not just for rotating. Everyone, 25% of diabetics inject insulin. So there's a huge number of people that are injecting, and I'm just like them, basically.
How has the process been going through the patenting and going through getting this tool on the market?
Yeah, so when I first came up with the idea, I sketched it out and then made a nuts and bolts prototype to test to make sure the concept worked. And then after that, I went and Googled researched some patent stuff and then ended up writing a provisional patent myself and then filed that and then pitched to the Discovery to Product program, who then helped me with mentorship and commercialization. And then when I was in D2P, I worked with a legal corps, a pro bono patent program, who then turned the provisional patent into a non-provisional patent. And then it was just after that, it was just waiting 2 years to hear back from the patent examiner. And then once we heard back from the patent examiner, we had to give him some more information, and then we ended up getting our patent issued in December of 2019. So it was a long roller coaster of a ride, but I'm really glad I did it because we ended up getting an issued patent out of it.
Well, Sean, thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And if anyone's interested on Steady Shot, check out mysteadyshot.com.
Sounds good. Shawn Michaels invented an insulin injection device. It's called Steady Shot. Coming up, we talk with a UW diabetes researcher about managing the disease. Are you type 1 or type 2? What questions do you have about controlling your blood sugar? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment for more on managing diabetes right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about managing diabetes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So diabetes is on the rise with no signs of slowing down. By 2030, nearly 55 million Americans are predicted to have either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And then the mounting costs, estimated to be north of $622 billion over the next decade. Have you recently been diagnosed with diabetes? How are you managing the disease? Are you pre-diabetic? What are you changing about your lifestyle? What questions do you have about insulin? We're at 800-642-1234. Michelle Kimple is an associate professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Michelle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about the injection sites for insulin. What are some of the ways diabetics get insulin into their bodies?
So we heard about injecting insulin, and there are a lot of diabetics, type 1 diabetics require insulin in order to live, but there are also a lot of type 2 diabetic individuals who need insulin. And
so type 1, you were diagnosed as a child. Type 2 is later onset in life?
Or that used to be the traditional viewpoint, but and it still is the case that most individuals with type 1 diabetes are diagnosed as children or adolescents or even early in their 20s. And that has to do somewhat with the link between childhood diseases as a trigger for type 1 diabetes. But there are, it is becoming clear that there are individuals who do develop type 1 diabetes later in life. Sometimes that has a genetic component. Sometimes nobody knows why. And then type 2 diabetes used to be considered more of a disease of aging. And as if you know anything about type 1 or type 2 diabetes, you might have heard of insulin resistance. And that just means that your body has to work harder to make insulin. So in some people, the beta cells in the body, which are the only cells that make insulin, sort of poop out. And so this tends to happen as you age and become insulin resistant throughout the natural course of aging. But obesity is also a huge factor in insulin resistance. And so that's scientists think that's why we're seeing more type 2 diabetic individuals diagnosed earlier in life before middle age, because they're already becoming insulin resistant.
What are some of the mechanisms that we maintain blood sugar, that we get that insulin?
So you, as we talked about before, you can inject insulin. A lot of people feel like they have more control when they're measuring their blood glucose throughout the day and deciding what injection to give themselves. There's different types of insulin. So there's long acting and rapid acting. And some individuals really like being able to have more control over that. But I think that a lot of individuals are really choosing to go with an insulin pump. And it still requires a continuous glucose monitor, and you still have to dial in when you're about to eat and put in the estimated amount of carbs, but it does make things a lot simpler. And for some people, especially who've struggled with the injections or maintaining their blood glucose in a healthy range throughout the day, the pump has become an attractive option.
Let's take a call now. Nikki in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, good morning. I'm very interested in this subject. Pre-diabetic when I was pregnant, had type 2 in probably in my 40s, and then as I got older, it changed to type 1 because of women having autoimmune problems. And my real worry is the cost of insulin. I have a pump now, and I'm 62, and I'm going to go to retirement age. I am very, very worried about the cost of insulin. But I do have to say about the pump, I was on injection pens, and now the pump, I probably got 8 or 9 years ago, it is a blessing. It is just a blessing to have a pump, and now I need a new one because I've changed insurances. But my fear is retiring and the cost, and how much equipment you have to have. And I cannot have a sugar glucose monitor because it's just too expensive. I have to still be pricking my finger.
Nikki, thank you so much for that. The cost of insulin, what are you seeing?
Well, as a researcher, I don't directly work with patients, but I am pretty active with working with our clinicians and on the Twitter sphere in the type 1 and type 2 diabetes arenas. And this is a huge, huge problem. And it's actually quite sad as a researcher because I could make new different types of insulin with different properties that could help people to better control their blood sugar. But the cost of that is prohibitive for a lot of people, and they're still using sort of our original type insulins that really aren't any different from the insulin that you could get in 1920. So
wow.
Yeah, and switching insurance is a problem too, because once you like we heard from Nikki, once you switch to a pump and you get really good glucose control and you switch insurance, you have to reapply to be eligible to get that pump. So in the 3 or 4 months while you're waiting, you have to go back to managing your blood sugar with just daily injections. And I don't think people understand what it's truly like to have diabetes that requires insulin. And a lot of type 1 and even type 2 diabetic individuals don't consider that a disability. But in my mind, anything that makes you alter your lifestyle is I wouldn't call it a diabetic individual disabled necessarily, but it's a huge, huge
impediment.
Factor.
Yes. Yeah. Let's bring in Ben now in West Salem. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I was very interested in your conversation. I've been to Madison for a transplant. I've been a type 1 diabetic since I was 11. I'm now 40. I've been through the roller coaster, as your caller before said, finding just access to insulin in most of my collegiate life. Like the gentleman who invented the invention before, I was a three-sport athlete in high school, same situation. I found out through sports that I was type 1 diabetic. But just finding my insulin throughout my entire life has been a problem, and I am a fighter, and I still lost the ability to use my kidneys because I never had direct access to insulin. I could never get it cheaply. When I was in high school, I could go buy a bottle. I think it was $46 when I bought it, cash, in college. And now I'm an adult, and I can't afford to buy insulin. That one bottle, I believe, is upwards of $400 now.
Oh, wow.
Fortunately, I haven't had to buy it in a while, but I have access to an Omnipod Dash, and I use the new Medicare CGM system from Dexcom. And I just can't imagine that as parents, anybody out there listening would not encourage their lawmakers to push through, at least for 18 and under, a CGM system, because if you know what your insulin is, you will take care of it. Part of the biggest problem is these children feel ostracized and they feel different. And we know how kids can be. They make little comments, but sometimes these comments make landslides.
Ben,
you know?
we're short on time here, but what is the system that Ben is referring to here?
So the Omnipod is one of the continuous insulin pumps.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's actually really convenient. It's essentially like three inches wide about, and it's got a sticky pad on it, and you just push it into your arm or whatever site you decide to use, and it's really convenient. So there are a lot of individuals who really like these devices.
In the short time we have left with you, is there any hope here on the horizon that we can make an insulin that is accessible, that is affordable, that can help people control their lives?
I mean, I think that the current insulin options we have could be affordable, and they're certainly available. It's just, I think that it's an issue with our entire healthcare system, And yet just a failure to understand what a hardship this is, and that it's really life or death for a lot of people. I mean, it's the saddest part is there are still people dying of complications from diabetes, and we have the tools to keep people alive and to let them lead a relatively normal life. So the fact this is still happening is very discouraging.
Michelle, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Michelle Kimple is an associate professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up, it's been nearly 2 weeks since the mass shooting at the Molson Coors Brewing Complex in Milwaukee. We'll check in on the investigation and what authorities are learning about the motive. That's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Molson Coors brewing lines are open, but nearly 2 weeks after a mass shooting, the employees at the campus in Milwaukee are working through many difficult questions. On February 26th, an electrician at the plant killed five of his coworkers before turning the gun on himself. Do you work at the Molson Coors complex, or do you live near the brewery? Where were you during the shooting? What do you want people to know about what happened? Join in the conversation at any point, 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers criminal justice, public health, and social issues in Milwaukee. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Help us understand, where does the investigation stand right now?
As far as we can tell, the investigation is still ongoing. The Milwaukee Police Department has not released very many updates. There's been no new information released so far this week. I understand it's only Tuesday. The signals that we've been getting as reporters is not to expect further information until the investigation has been concluded, at least from the Milwaukee Police Department's perspective.
And these investigations can take weeks, months?
Absolutely. I was just looking at some other mass shootings that have occurred in the country and some of the timeframes for information to be released there. In Las Vegas, a mass shooting at a country music festival in October of 2017, that remained under investigation by the FBI until about January of 2019, which was when a report was released indicating that the FBI could find no definitive motive in that particular case. In 2019, there was a mass shooting in Midland, Texas. And although the police department there released information about the shooter who after killing seven people, the shooter was shot and killed by police officers, the department released some information about the shooter, but it wasn't until months later that they released hundreds of pages more in a detailed timeline of how they determined the shooting had unfolded and more information. And still, the ATF and FBI consider that one an open investigation even now and are still looking into where the weapon, how the weapons were obtained and that sort of thing. So these kinds of investigations can stretch on even when it may seem to the public that there might not be anything further to investigate.
Ashley, do we know how many agencies are in this investigation, are doing the investigation in the Molson Coors shooting?
We know that the Milwaukee Police Department is the primary investigating agency. We also know that there were probably at least a half dozen or more agencies that initially responded, including the FBI. Presumably the ATF was also involved because firearms were involved as well. The Milwaukee Fire Department was there. There are a lot of important public safety questions that need to be answered, in large part because this was a mass shooting. It also took place in an industrial setting, so there presumably were a lot of other steps taken by public safety agencies to contain the area, make sure no chemicals were at risk for hurting other people at the scene or the wider neighborhood and that sort of thing. So as far as we know, there were quite a few agencies that responded. As far as continuing with the investigation, I believe it's primarily the Milwaukee Police Department. It's our understanding the FBI was there on the ground for the first day or two and then handed off primary investigative functions to the Milwaukee Police Department.
Tell us more about the gunman and what you have found out. He's been identified as a 51-year-old man from Milwaukee who worked at Molson Coors. What can you tell us about Anthony Farrell?
So my colleagues have done incredible reporting, trying to figure out as much as they can about the shooter in this particular incident. And what they've been able to glean is as you said earlier, he was an electrician. He had worked at Molson Coors for about 17 years. He had spent 20 years as an electrician. He, you know, does not have really any prior criminal history, significant criminal history or mental health problems that people spoke of, documented mental health problems. There were some reports of, coworkers and some law enforcement telling us some people seem to recall maybe some, some unusual behavior. Maybe he seemed a little bit different, but, you know, it's hard. We haven't been able as reporters to get a good picture of what that change in behavior might have been other than, you know, one person saying, well, he seemed like, you know, to think people might be following him and perhaps this was related to a workman's compensation claim and that sort of thing. By all accounts, you know, he was well respected. He was good at his job. And again, just as we had some coworkers saying, we heard that he believed workers or people from the brewery were coming into his home or maybe bugging his phone. We had other coworkers that we quoted who said, you know, he seemed fine earlier that week and that, you know, that he, other coworkers who said, I had no clue there was any sort of problem.
Do we know anything about the weapon that was used?
We know from law enforcement sources that two guns were used and one of them had a silencer. We know that, the shooter seemed to be a gun enthusiast from law enforcement sources and some neighbors. He apparently spoke about that and he had an interest in firearms. He, as far as we could tell, he could absolutely legally have them and sort of collected them. And that's what we know so far. We don't know. We haven't confirmed any further details on that.
We're talking with Ashley Lutheran, an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been part of a reporting team covering the aftermath of the shooting. Do you work at Molson Coors in Milwaukee, or do you live near the brewery? Where were you at the point of the workplace shooting, and how are you processing what happened? How do you feel today? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Ashley, can you take us back to February 26th, that afternoon? What have police said as far as the timeline of what unfolded there at the brewery?
Sure. I can let you know what I am aware of, and I will be perfectly upfront here. I was actually out of town the day that this shooting occurred, and my colleagues, I was in the position to be a reader and following the coverage myself. And then jumping back into the coverage the weekend after when I returned. And so the Milwaukee Police Department had three news conferences, two the day of the shooting, one the day after, as well as the police chief also went on WTMJ radio that Thursday. And in that time, they provided some basic information about the initial call. In the news conference the day after the shooting, they identified the victims as well as the shooter. And then they did not release further information until last week when they provided a written statement saying that as of their initial investigation, which is based off of witness interviews, they did not believe that race or racism had been identified as a factor in the incident and that they, as of right now in their initial investigation, do not believe that the shooter was influenced or motivated by retaliation for any racist acts that had occurred in the workplace.
But there have been some reports suggesting racial tension at the brewery. It was confirmed that a noose was found in the shooter's locker 5 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. And so again, that's why when we're reporting this information, we're, you know, we're attributing it to the Milwaukee Police Department based off of their initial information that's as what they have for possible motivation right now. But what has been documented is we do know that, you know, several to a half dozen former Molson Coors employees have been speaking out very publicly about the racial discrimination they experienced when they worked at the plant. And as far as the shooter, he did 5 years ago have a noose placed on or in his locker when he was not there. The company confirmed that last week. They indicated that their human resources department notified the employee about that because he wasn't at work, and that there were that there was action taken. They said that they weren't able to determine who had placed the noose in that area because there weren't apparently security videos there. In the wake of that, there was a mass staff meeting, and we spoke with workers who were there at the time who remembered that meeting and who remembered that even though Anthony Farrell's name was not mentioned, that it was understood throughout the plant that he was the person who had been targeted by that. But it would it's hard for us. We were able to confirm that. Mr. Farrell's family has not given any interviews. They have released a statement expressing sympathy to the victims and declining interview requests. So we haven't heard from his family about if there were any, about if he talked about his experiences at work or anything like that. And then as far as documents, you know, my colleagues and I have been trying to see if there were, you know, there were early reports that perhaps the shooter had sued the company for discrimination before. We have not been able to find any record of that. We have not been able to find any record of him filing any formal complaints. However, as I said, we were able, through former employees and then ultimately the company, also confirmed the report of the noose that occurred 5 years ago.
Did he have any long-running disputes with coworkers? What was his relationship like with his coworkers?
We know that he and the victims all knew each other. They had worked together for some time. There have been a couple different reports as to different disputes. One of my colleagues reported how, you know, one coworker suggested, yes, there was some back and forth with a the shooter had some back and forth with another coworker, things like hiding tools, that sort of thing. It's unclear. You know, at this point, we don't know if there was any particular individual that he was targeting because of any ongoing dispute or not. We have some law enforcement sources saying it appears that there was some sort of dispute or he had some sort of issue with a coworker. But we, at the Journal Sentinel, are not clear, you know, who that may have been or what the nature of that dispute might have been.
We're circling back to the Molson Coors shooting, what is known now nearly 2 weeks later. Ashley Lutheran is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Do you live in Milwaukee? How has the community come together following the shooting? Did you go to a vigil to honor the victims? Maybe you work in law enforcement or as a detective interviewing witnesses. What should the public understand about these shooting investigations? Join in at any point here, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with Ashley Lutheran here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Brewing production lines reopened last week, but questions remain about workplace culture at Molson Coors nearly 2 weeks after the mass shooting at its Milwaukee campus. And in the days since the shooting, a crowdsourced fund to support the families of victims, it's topped $1.1 million. What questions do you want answered about this workplace shooting? What information do you want the police to share? Do you know any of the victims? What do you want us to remember about them? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative reporter Ashley Lutheran stays with us. So, Ashley, Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales has held several news conferences, as you mentioned, since the shooting, and here he is identifying the five victims killed.
Jesus Valle, 33-year-old resident of Milwaukee. Jean Lefschetz, 51-year-old resident of Mequon. Trevor Wetzler, 33-year-old resident of Milwaukee. Dana Walk, a 57-year-old resident of Delafield, and Dale Hudson, a 50-year-old resident of Waukesha.
As you hear those names and the victims, what more do we know about them? Have they had funerals?
Yes, we know that some have had funerals. Some are services are still pending for others. You know, we know things like, you know, Dale Hudson, you know, was spoken very highly of by coworkers. He liked to hunt. He was a fisherman. You know, he apparently was good friends with another one of the victims, Dana Walk, who was a machinist. Dana was a graduate of Kettle Moraine High School, married with some children. He also apparently was an avid fisherman, according to his obituary. We know that Jesus's family, they've been sharing tributes on social media, talking about trauma their family already had suffered because of gun violence. And we know that Gene had immigrated from Ukraine to Mequon, and that he had, you know, he was, you know, quite well known in his community. Services for him occurred last weekend, and Congresswoman Gwen Moore has talked about her friendship with him on the congressional floor. Trevor was an engine room operator and grew up in the area. He apparently graduated from Pius and UW-Madison. And just in general, I think there's been a lot of remembrance for the victims. I know that my colleagues have been working on fuller obituaries of all of them. You know, they were remembered at several church services as well as a vigil outside of City Hall the weekend after the shooting.
Let's bring in a call now. Trevor is joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Trevor.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I just wanted to mention my office is on 32nd and Highland, and I happened to be in a meeting the day of the shootings, and we heard the sirens, you know, pretty much nonstop for about 30 minutes. I really just wanted to comment and say that Milwaukee PD and anyone that helped with law enforcement just did an amazing job. They had that the block pretty much secured within about 30-40 minutes. An officer stopped at our building. We were locked down. That's really all I wanted to comment on. Was I was just amazed at the reaction time and how professionally it was handled. I felt very safe being only two blocks away.
Trevor, thank you for bringing in your perspective and where you were. Ashley, how has the response of police been looked at in this particular workplace shooting?
Well, I thank Trevor for calling in and providing that perspective. You know, I think as far as what the public could tell, you know, that area was quite contained, quite secure. It was very clear that law enforcement officials were being very methodical in trying to account for all individuals at the workplace. I know that was something the police chief spoke about, you know, clearing, you know, 1,000 people working in that area. And so as far as the broader response, we don't know too much about that. As I said earlier, we don't have any of the reports sort of showing that or showing, you know, sort of all the different and, quite frankly, very numerous technical things that had to happen in order to contain that area, make sure it was secure. Again, not just make sure individuals were secure and no longer at threat from any kind of shooting, but also dealing with the chemicals and everything that goes around having an industrial plant.
We're talking
that is no longer being actively attended to.
Yeah, we're talking with Ashley Lutheran, an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's part of a group of reporters covering the aftermath of the shooting at the Molson Coors facility that happened on February 26. Ashley, since the shooting, what's been the status of operations at Molson Coors at this really large facility?
So we know that as of midweek, as of Thursday, during a media briefing that Molson Coors provided, it was last Wednesday night that the brewery kind of resumed operations. And at that time, the officials said, you know, we expect the brewery will be fully operational in the coming days in a short time period. The company has really stepped forward and said, you know, we're going to provide emotional support for our employees. grief counseling, trauma counseling. They've increased security measures. We know from company emails sent to employees that they've instituted bag checks. They were increasing security patrols. And that the company has also come out and said they are taking very seriously the reports of problems in their workplace culture. Adam Collins, who's the Chief Communications and Corporate Affairs Officer, said the company has work to do. They're committed to doing that work. They're beginning with meeting with current employees and working with some outside partners to address those issues of workplace culture as well.
When you say bag checks, is that for employees when they enter the building, when they exit the building? How has security changed?
It's my understanding that it's for employees as they enter the building, that their bags are being screened and checked. And to the best of our knowledge, that was not instituted beforehand. And that's one thing my colleague, Rick Barrett, who has covered this company before, he and I have been discussing, because it is hard to know exactly what security measures were in place. We've asked, but it's unclear to us, for example, what specific security measures and policies, employees' policies were in place before this happened. We know what's happened since then. We know about the bag checks. We know about the increased patrols. But we're not sure, for example, when the last time there was an active shooter drill at the plant or any of those kinds of things.
You had mentioned that the employees are getting some support at this time. Do you know about any type of support being given to the employees who are going to work each day?
We know that Molson has said that their employee assistance program is, working around the clock to try to provide as whatever support is needed for employees. We know that the unions, and there are quite a few who represent employees in various parts of the plant, that they also often have their own EAP services that they are making available, or not even just making available, they're making sure employees are reminded that those are available as well if they would like to use those services instead of the company's. And then in addition, the company said just having trained professionals. And we know my colleagues wrote a story about the wider community response that's not law enforcement, that is focused on, addressing trauma and mental health that also sort of responded to this scene. So you had the Salvation Army Chaplaincy Program, you had the Office of Violence Prevention, you had victim advocates from the District Attorney's Office, all responding to that scene and just helping to provide as much emotional support as they could at that time and making sure people knew about the resources available to them in the community as well.
At the outset, you said investigations like these take a long time. What is the next step? What are you watching for?
I am watching for any additional public statements that come from the Milwaukee Police Department, primarily, if they're going to share any other information in advance of finishing the investigation, in which reports would then be available under open records. But really, I would just echo what you have asked people to do this morning. If you have information that you would like reporters to know, or questions that you want us to look into, or experiences that you want to share, I would ask that you contact the Journal Sentinel. Our newsroom number is 414-224-2318. We are going to be continuing to look into this for many weeks to come, I am sure. And even if it's something that, we're interested in all information that we can to try to guide our questions as we're deciding where to put our reporting resources. So,
Ashley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Ashley Luthern is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers criminal justice, public health, and social issues in Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.